Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Carla Long, and today you're listening to Percolating on Faith, a podcast where we get together with our dear friends, Charmaine and Tony Shavala Smith, and we talk about super duper smart things. And when I say we talk about super duper smart things, I mean, really, they talk about super smart things. And I just get to sit here and listen and feel smart. So thank you, gentle listener, for helping me feel smart once a month. I appreciate it. So hello, Charmaine. Hello, Tony. Welcome back.
Hi, Carla. Good to be with you. And the truth of things is probably that we talk so much that we hardly ever make any room for you to have any input, but we really appreciate having this time with you and the really good questions you bring.
Oh, well, like thank you. I'm a good question asker. That's true. Thanks for that. So today we're going to talk about, and this is like the short title, why do bad things happen to good people? And I'm quite interested in this because I'm going to let you know, I'm one of the goodest people I know.
Humblest, it sounds
and
like.
The humblest as well. And there are some bad things that happen to me. So I don't think bad things should happen to me because I am so, so good. But there is a super, there's like definitely a theology behind that when people think that and when people wonder that question. So can we talk about a little bit about maybe the theology behind that first? Like,
absolutely.
Why is that even a question that people have?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it really, this is exactly the point. There's some assumptions behind even that question. Why do bad things happen to good people? I mean, it's basically suggesting that the way things should be is that only good things should happen to good people. So it's already a theological statement that's being made that somehow good people, if they're really good, shouldn't ever suffer. They shouldn't ever have loss or grief. And so I think as we start to say that, people might begin to see what some of the problems are with that assumption, that somehow that's how God set it up, as though good people shouldn't suffer. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's one of the assumptions that's already in the question.
And another assumption that's in the question is one, I'm going to frame it this way, and you as a mathematician are going to like the way I frame it, that the question presumes that the universe functions by a kind of moral calculus, right? In other words, X should yield this, Y should yield this all the time. And the question really is, where did that moral calculus come from? Why would one assume that to start with? And what does it mean that our actual experience does not follow, does not compute with that? So, we'll eventually get to where some of that moral calculus idea comes from. It does come from religious traditions, but it's
also
it's
philosophies, mm-hmm. ancient philosophies.
Yeah. And so these assumptions are built into the question. The question seems innocent at first, but most, pretty much all, I'll say, questions of a theological nature always presuppose or assume something, or already have a starting point that may itself need to be questioned. So, also, I mean, another thing that could be questioned about that question is, what do you mean by good? Right. So, good is itself a question begging term. So
it's a relative thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How are you measuring that a person is good? And also, you might also question, what is a situation that is bad? What makes something bad? Is it just because it makes us uncomfortable, or it doesn't give us what we want? Or it might be evil or bad, but we also have to look at that. So one of the things that, you know, those assumptions, those theological assumptions point to, is that they point to this idea that somehow God's major role is to make us happy and successful and comfortable. And then we have to ask, is that really the God that we know? And so that's where we start to help people unpack the assumptions that are there. And yeah, there may be a lot of people who think that God's main role in the universe is that I personally have a comfortable life, right? And we want to believe that, but there's no precedent for that. I mean, go to the Old Testament. Look at the people who are doing God's will, the prophets. Well, what happens to them? Well, gosh, they're ostracized. They're made fun of. They're not listened to. They're not taken seriously. Doing the things God wants us to do does not mean there's not promises that it's going to be easy or that we're going to be comfortable. So New Testament, Jesus' most faithful followers. Well, you know, some of them were crucified. Some of them were killed by the Romans. So why do we think that what God wants most for us is to be, you know, rich and famous or comfortable and successful? We have to question what is it we think God is? Do we think God is our personal valet? And this question kind of points to that somehow we think that God's main job is my comfort. So some ways to start looking at what's behind the question. It's a valid question to ask, why is there suffering? And we're going to look into some of the ways in which that has been answered theologically in popular culture, but also some of the kind of enduring theological approaches to suffering that don't make God our
servant, our slave.
Yeah, exactly. doesn't make the universe about us, about me. And I think that's important.
And when you think about it, how is it that finite creatures, there was a time when we weren't, there will be a time when we aren't, finite creatures who have limits, who have bodies, who are bodies, who have, pain receptors, on what grounds would we assume that a universe in which we live would not be filled with risk, trial, pain, struggle, pain, and in other words,
loss, grief.
Yes. What I'm getting towards is that somewhere behind that question, it depends on the culture it's asked in, but somewhere behind that question, when it's asked, say, in the American context, the North American context, the Northern Hemisphere context, sometimes when that question is asked, behind it is the assumption that our lives should be free from anything that's just uncomfortable and that causes struggle. It's like, where does that come from? And actually, one place it comes from, I think, is insecurity. We are justifiably insecure beings because of our finitude, right? That's part of
it. We know we're going to die. Yeah, we know that we're vulnerable.
Right. And so we're always looking for a theory or a formula or something that will somehow make the universe function like a clock for us, right? And so, in other words, what we're trying to do here is just unravel a lot of assumptions that are built into the question.
Well, it jumps back into that moral calculus thing. Calculus is, and I'm just going to do the definition of calculus right now.
It's wonderful.
A systematic way of describing systems that change. So we are so desperate to figure out a system. So if I do this, then I get this, because it feels so good to know that helping an old lady across the street is going to get me $10 in the future. You know, like that feels so good to know. And I want that to know that, because we are insecure. You're absolutely right. So it goes back, everything goes back to math.
Yes. It does. And it also goes back to this psychological desire, need for control. What you're describing is this assurance that we have control over what will happen to us. And we assume God is going to go along with us on that and do God's part.
And I just want to say, Carla, when you were starting to go into a definition of calculus, I was beginning to feel inwardly existential terror. And I was wondering where God was in that moment, because it was so frightening to hear a definition of calculus that that I thought I was alone and abandoned in the universe for a second there, but I feel better now.
For our gentle listeners, you might be gathering that Tony has a little phobia of math. I'm a little traumatized by it, but anyhow. So when this question is asked, why do bad things happen to good people in our culture, there tends to be three kind of little pat answers that you'll hear. And so we're going to give those to you, and then we're going to unpack them a little bit. Maybe trash them a little bit. It's really where we're headed. So just saying.
Unpack and discard.
So these are ones that you've probably heard, or you might embody yourself, because we absorb them. We absorb them from the culture around us because sometimes they help. Sometimes they make momentary sense of the suffering that we feel or that we see others feeling. So one that's really popular, and I would say very dangerous, is everything happens for a reason. And that one, it's saying a lot of things, but not really claiming them. So it's saying, well, everything, but it's said as a theological statement, and it's implying that everything that happens, God is orchestrating it. Well, that's really not very satisfying, because it implies that everything, including bad or evil things, are God's will, or that God made it happen. And so when you think about wars that are happening, when you think about atrocities, when you think about rape, when you think about child abuse, when you think about all of these things, you have to ask yourself, did God make this happen? Did God let this happen? Is it God who is it? It's, you know, there's this, everything happens for a reason, suggests that there's this huge blueprint, mm-hmm. and that everything that happens is part of that blueprint, and that God planned it and wanted it, mm-hmm. that this is God's will. And so we have to, this is not very satisfying when we say everything happens for a reason, because it's saying that God is the orchestrator or the creator of evil and makes bad things happen to people on purpose.
and with each of these we'll articulate, you really need to step back and ask the question, what is the imagined character of God or who is doing such things, right?
Right.
So how do we imagine the attributes
here? What kind of God is this?
Yeah.
But the reason I think this one gets so much play is because it's very convenient. When you say everything happens for a reason, you can step back. You don't have to get involved. You don't have to identify what system is creating this evil, this oppression, this suffering, and do anything about it, because, well, that's just the way things are. That's how they're going to be. And so it's really, there's nothing we can do to change things. So we won't. We won't even worry ourselves about it. And in fact, this is kind of the back door for, this is a theological back door when people don't know what to say and mm-hmm. when they don't know how to engage in other people's suffering. It's like, well, everything happens for a reason. So it's a way to say, too bad for you. You know, yeah. This all has to have some, and this can become also very fatalistic. Fatalistic meaning, well, things are just going to be the way they are. And so there's no room for hope. There's no room for personal development or wanting to change or grow, change situations around us. And fatalism can kill hope and dreams in people. And, you know, I don't think we think about that when we hear, well, everything happens for a reason, but that's definitely one of the places it goes. And so this idea is really not substantively Christian.
Mm-hmm. In fact, when people say this, everything happens for a reason, they may not recognize that what they're doing is they're channeling ancient Stoic philosophy, right? The Stoic philosophers were trying to make sense of their lives in terms of questions of suffering and so on. And basically, they concluded, look, the universe is rational because we can make certain sense out of it. And they had this principle of reason that's reason is embedded in everything, and reason is the all-controlling principle. And whatever happens is what reason wants, right? What rationality wants. And it can't happen other than how rationality wants. And by the way, in Stoic mythology, they held that the universe began in a kind of a cosmic explosion. Sounds a little Big Bang-ish, but began in a sort of a cosmic explosion, and it was going to go out and then come back in and start over again, and everything would happen the same way next time through the cycle, right? Groundhog Day, over and over and over again. And so where did they go with this? Ah, well, this was the way the Stoic was able to practice the virtue of apatheia, Greek word for apathy, basically, passionlessness. Don't sweat it. It's all going to happen the same way. This is how reason ordained it. Everything happens according to reason. And so all you can do is accept what is as what is and what will always be. The only thing you can change is your attitude about it. So buck up. Take whatever comes. And reason will do it all over again. And so get used to it. And so it always surprises me when I hear church members say, oh, everything happens for a reason. What they are intending to say, they're intending to find some kind of way to make sense of or make meaning out of a bad situation, but they don't realize they're actually reproducing a Stoic cosmology from centuries ago that is, as Charmaine said, it's utterly fatalistic. And the idea was it helps you deal with suffering by simply bucking up and taking it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes when people use this, they're meaning something different. They may say, well, God can meet us wherever we find ourselves, whatever situation we find ourselves in, God can meet us there and make something good out of it. That's very different, though, than the idea that everything that's happening, it happens for a reason. A God-given reason is the implied piece here. So another of the kind of understandings that feed into this idea of this whole idea of why are bad things happening to good people is a theology, not the theology, but a theology from the Old Testament, which is called retribution theology. And in this one, it's so apparent in the presupposition of the question of why do bad things happen to good people. So here what it is, retribution theology says, if you do good, you get good. And if you do bad, you get bad. And if bad things are happening to you, well, you must have done something bad. Yes, exactly. Shame on you. And if you can't figure out what it is that you've done bad, well, then you're not going deep enough. You know, you're not. And so this is all based on goodness and badness. Again, though, who gets to measure that? But again, it's assuming that we have control over what will happen in our lives. Again, this moral calculus mm-hmm. is the basis there. Mm-hmm. And you'll find this in various places in the Old Testament and New Testament. It's only one of the theologies that you'll find. And you'll find some places that argue very vigorously mm-hmm. against this. The book of Job, for instance. This mm-hmm. is all about answering this question of why do bad things happen to good people? And they kind of trash it there too. But this doesn't measure up to the God that we know.
So I think it's important to understand that in the Hebrew Bible, there's a context behind this. And that is that in the Hebrew Bible, for most of it, until you get to the very latest book, which is Daniel, there's no concept of life after death, no concept of a future writing of things, no concept of future rewards and punishments, whatever that all means. In the Hebrew Bible, it's all about this life. What You know, everybody goes to the same place when they die, Sheol, which is the abode of the dead, all of them, good, bad, and ugly. Everybody's there. and so.
And they all fade away over time.
Yeah, your shadow just fades. Yeah. And so with the Hebrew Bible's strong sense of divine justice, where does that justice get worked out? Well, it must get worked out in this life, this theology holds. And so thus this idea of
if you
do good and so on and so forth. But
there's two dangers to it, huge dangers, really. And that is to say that if someone is having a hard time in their life, they deserve it. They must have done something wrong. And so they deserve. So we hear this a lot. You know, we hear of it with poor people, or we hear of it when people are talking about the homeless. Well, you know, they just need to get a job and pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. And so it's implying that they deserve what they've got. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, another danger on the other side is, well, then you start lifting up rich people, even if they got rich by doing bad things like abusing others, taking advantage of their workers, of destroying the creation. But because they're being blessed, because they're rich and famous and things, then all the exterior things would say, well, God favors them over everybody else. And look, they have all of these things. So if you're getting good, then you must be good in God's eyes. Mm-hmm. And then of course that can give people who already have wealth and power, even more wealth and power, and the admiration of religious people, even though their intentions may be very evil and bad. Say, you know, maybe some politicians that we've heard of at some point that have used this kind of idea to say, well, God is obviously blessing me.
Yeah. By the way, Jesus, who was Jewish, knew of this theology, and he critiqued it at least a couple places in the gospel. So in the Gospel of John, the story about the man who was born blind, the disciples said, who sinned, this man or his parents? And Jesus' first response to them is neither. And then there's a story in Luke where Jesus says, you know that incident in Siloam where a tower fell and killed a bunch of people? Did that happen because they were worse sinners than everybody else? No. So Jesus himself rejected this. In the spirit of the author of the book of Job, Jesus rejected this kind of if you do good, you get good. If you do bad, blah, blah, blah. And in fact, Jesus says of God, he makes the sun shine on the just and the unjust, which is a kind of a categorical critique of the whole idea that there's a moral calculus in the universe.
There's even more to it than that. Even like I would never consider myself wealthy, but I'm wealthier than most of the people in the world probably. And so am I in the middle good? And the celebrities and millionaires, are they extra good? Yeah. And you know, like, so I mean, are there levels of goodness in here? So like it gets really complicated really quickly.
Yes, it does. Which is why the simplism of this kind of a theory just does not hold up to reality, which is what the author, the final author of the book of Job, was trying to point out.
So these two that we've already just described, everything happens for a purpose, and the theology of retribution. If you do good, you get good. If you do bad, you get bad. They have some things in common, and basically both are saying that whatever happens is somehow God's doing. But there's a different tone with each of them. The first one, everything happens for a reason, is often said for people to distance themselves from someone else's suffering. It's an easy step back and an assurance that and then we don't have to get involved. We don't have to help the sufferer. So it's kind of more of an observation. Well, everything happens for a reason. Just hang on long enough. Something good might happen. Well, but the theology of retribution, if someone is claiming that kind of diagnosing the situation by saying, well, you know, if you do good, you get good. If you, that's a difference here is that the person using that to describe the problem is putting themselves in a higher place. I know God's will for you. And if you're suffering right now, I can judge you because you've obviously done something bad. And so this one actually puts the speaker, the diagnoser, the so-called friend or support in this godlike role, this godlike position, where they know more than the one who is suffering, and they can speak for God in the other's life. And then that's dangerous. That kind of destroys the idea of equality in Christ. So that's one of the ways in which those are similar. The other thing that they have in common, another similarity between these two, is that both pretend that there is only one determining causality in the world, that God is the only power at work in the world. And so anything that happens somehow is intended by God. So some of the people, probably most of the people who use either of these descriptions for why good people suffer, they probably believe in science or benefit from it. They probably understand a little bit about weather patterns and how storms happen. They might even take vaccines or wear masks because they understand that disease doesn't come because you're bad or you're good. It comes being passed along by a virus or a germ or, you know, whatever. So on one level, they understand that there are these other causalities. There are causalities in nature. There are some of the big tragic natural events that happen, that those affect things, mudslides and storms and hurricanes and all of those things. Those can bring suffering to people. They recognize that that's another causality, another power source that's working. They know, they understand that disease can be something that can cause suffering, but they're still choosing to assume that there's really only God that determines how things are going to come out. And so I think that's another thing to recognize, is they're not acknowledging that in our individual lives, there's a lot of sources, a lot of determining causalities. There's, you know, our cultural upbringing. There's the environment that we are exposed to. There is what's happening in science and in the natural world, that these are all causalities as well. Governments and the power that they have over people is a causality that can, you know, think about Flint and the lead in the water. This is causing terrible suffering because there's this other causality that is also affecting that. And so both of these ways of understanding are ignoring the reality that there are many causes for suffering. And they're trying to say, well, God has it all under control. And, you know, and they're ignoring that fact that they do recognize these other things.
And there are some kinds of causalities we have control over, right? Bad political decisions that yield suffering for groups of people, we do have control over who we vote for and what kinds of policies we stand for and so on. We have some control over pollution and degradation of the environment. And there's so many areas. Causality is really complicated. Mm-hmm. And reducing causality to a single causality, that God's causing everything, is not even accurate to the Bible as a whole. It's certainly not accurate to the best of Christian theology, and it doesn't even fit our experience very well. It's once again a simple, safe way to feel like you've got things under control, when in fact Even medieval theologians like Thomas Aquinas understood that there are multiple levels of causality, you know, that in a sense, God is the ultimate cause of the universe, but then there are secondary levels of causality that function. God created a world in which there are other levels of causality that can function. That's the precondition of freedom and development. And so reducing things to single causality, i.e. a divine cause, actually complicates the picture morally a lot, and also then disempowers human beings from changing causes we could change.
Exactly.
And I think that right there is the last thing you said is a really important point, because it actually takes away humans' power, right? Like, we want to be in control. We want to know that this equals this, but that makes us powerless, that we don't get to, that we don't actually are not in control of anything. So that right there is a reason for not to believe in that singular causality that God is making everything happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a different thing to say altogether that God is present as the ground of all things, in the midst of all things. God is always present. That's a different thing than to see God as kind of a cosmic puppet master who is orchestrating whether you found a parking place or not, and or who's getting COVID or what, you know. And that's simply everybody would hate a person who was like that.
A micromanager.
Yeah, right. And so theoretically we're supposed to love God and love neighbor, but when you have conceptions of God like this, it's pretty hard it's actually hard to do both then, right? So
you might fear God, but you're probably not going to love God.
Yeah.
So, and then the third of these things that we would identify as being explanations that go along with the question, you know, why do bad things happen to good people, is the suggestion, the solution, well, you're being tested. And, you know, this, whatever struggle you're having is a test to, it's a divinely given test to see if your faith is good, you know, whether or not you have enough faith, or to help you grow faith. Yeah, Carla.
This is just, I just want to make a really fast statement and say this idea is rampant in Utah. Like, we hear this all the time in Utah about God testing your faith. And it just, and my heart just shrivels every time I hear it. So please continue. This is a really important thing to hear.
Yeah.
Well, again, you have to ask the question, what kind of God does this make God? You know, is God a schoolmarm with a ruler who wants to smack your hands when you get a wrong answer? Is that the kind of growth that this kind of a God wants, is one that's based on fear? So, you know, this whole idea of that anything bad that's happening to you is a test, it's still assuming that God is the primary causality, and that you have to be good enough. You have to have passed the test to not have any more struggles. So it's still feeding into some of the same things as the other two approaches do.
Yeah. So the idea here is that, like, God is somehow trying to test us to see what we're made of, as if God doesn't already know what we're made of. And, you know, on that score, God doesn't need to lead Tony to a pizza buffet to see how much pizza Tony will actually eat. God already knows that Tony will eat 8, 10, 12 pieces when he goes to a pizza. It's like, why does God need to figure that out? Right. So, and by the way, in the New Testament, in the book of James in chapter 1, there's a cool statement that God does not test or tempt anyone. Tempt in Greek is one word, so it can be translated either way. God does not test or tempt anyone. We're tempted or tested by our own desires. It's what the book of James says, which I think is really cool. It's like, that is so existentially true. God's not testing me at the pizza buffet. I am testing me at the pizza buffet. And I'm here to tell you, Carla, I will fail every time.
Tony, don't think I haven't seen it for myself.
So this is one of those places, again, where there may be a positive idea here, that in some ways there may be this idea of testing going on in our lives, but not that God is testing us, but that life is testing us and God is willing to be with us to help us grow, to help. I mean, that's completely different. It's just the changing of a couple of words. And sometimes that's what people may mean, but it gets turned into this conniving God who's trying to make you stumble so that you can be judged, or that you can, you know, or so that more bad things can happen to you, or maybe you'll just get it right either by effort or by accident, and then somehow then you're better with God than you were before. So again, this is, what a kind of God is this? And again, you know, all of us have tests in our lives. Sometimes they're the ones we put ourselves through in the pizza buffet. Sometimes they're the struggles of growth and relationships and just interaction with people and the world. And we can talk about testing as saying, when life tests us, God asks us to invite God to be with us, and God can help us grow from it, heal from it, walk away from it. So that's a completely different way of looking at it. And not that God made these tests so that, you know, we'll fall in the ditch. So, you know, people who may talk about tests may also think of God as being gracious and invitational, and they might not realize that these two ideas are not congruent. That, you know, if we believe that God is gracious and loving, then we see God is always inviting us to take the next step that we can, not having some predetermined exam that we have to get right in order to go on to the next grade, but an invitation, you know, a gracious God who's inviting us to discover with God the next step in our journey.
That reminds me, Carla, God is not like Tony, feared by generations of students for the saying, all right, take out a piece of paper and write your name in the upper right-hand corner.
Right. Pop quiz day.
There's a lot of reasons that I am glad that God and Tony are not the same being, but there's some reasons I think God and Tony could be the same being.
I'm not seeing it, but
yeah, right. Whatever. As the person who lives closest to me, and she's not going to see that either, but you know, the idea that God is testing you, again, it's about trying to control reality. Now look, Thomas A. Kempis, this great 14th century spiritual writer, says in Imitation of Christ, occasions, things that happen, show us what we are. There's a great truth in that, right? Things that happen each day, the big ones, the little ones, the painful ones, the not so painful ones, they constantly show us what we're made of. They can be a vehicle by which we grow. But the idea that God is somehow manipulating those to figure out something that God already knows about us is kind of a bizarre idea, really. And the question is, you know, to come back to where Charmaine was a few minutes ago, that in the occasions, in the events that happen to us, through us, with us, the real question is, how will we let the God of love and grace be present with us and part of the experience as we work through it? That's a different question altogether.
So we've kind of gone through those three very common ways of trying to understand why bad things happen to good people. And we've also kind of looked behind the question itself to see what some of the presuppositions are. But now we want to give you some tools. And so these are called theodicies. And a theodicy is an explanation of where does suffering come from and where is God in it, or
how does one justify belief in God in the face of the miserable things that happen in life, in history, for peoples, for cultures, for individuals? How does one continue to believe in God in the midst of all of that? So a theodicy is an attempt to try and articulate these different pieces, suffering, evil, the presence of God, God's love, justice, and so on. How do we hold that all together? And hey, nobody's got the right one here, but there are some different types of them that come up in theology that are worth looking at and can give us some tools, as Charmaine mentioned, to think about stuff.
And there's a bunch of them. We've identified six, but we're only going to really cover three. And to give some explanation of how you can see suffering and God, and where they interchange, mm-hmm. where we can see good possibilities in them.
So the first one we'll look at very briefly is sometimes called the Irenaean theodicy. It goes back to Saint Irenaeus, a bishop in what is now France, Gaul, in the Roman Empire, a bishop in southern Gaul in the second century, in the 130 to 202. And Irenaeus had a couple of challenges he was facing as a leader of Christian communities in southern France in that period. One was Roman persecution that was absolutely vicious. We have actual records of what the Romans did to Christians. It was unbelievably barbaric. And so he's got that to deal with. But then he's got an internal difficulty in the church, which is people who've adopted this Gnostic mythology from the surrounding culture, who are starting to say, hey, you know, the reason they're suffering at all is because there's matter, because there's a physical universe, and the physical universe is a mistake, and death will just release us from all this. And Irenaeus is like, no, God is the good creator of the good earth. And so one of his ways of trying to deal with the question is he argues that, well, God created human beings imperfect and immature as children. Adam and Eve he sees as children, so that there's the possibility of growth. Right? God created a universe in such a way that there would be the possibility of growth. And the only way that there can be growth is if there's the possibility of choices. God did not create evil, but the very fact of creating good creates a kind of a shadow side. And we can opt for the shadow side if we want to, but choosing the good helps us grow morally. So there's kind of a moral growth involved in it. That was part of his way of articulating it.
And even our bad choices can help us grow morally. And so God can work with the good and the bad things that happen in our lives for growth.
So for your next,
so yeah. Again, mm-hmm. You're not judged because you make mistakes. It's inevitable. It's inevitable that you're going to make mistakes, but it becomes an arena where you can do some growing.
And for Irenaeus, Christ comes as he uses the term recapitulation. Christ sums up who humanity is supposed to be and thereby gives us both a model and the power through the life of the church and sacraments to make moral growth as we have to deal with the struggling and suffering that's around us and in us. And so basically Irenaeus is saying the world is created in such a way that what can happen is that persons can grow and mature. And the very idea of growth and maturity requires that there will be difficulty, struggle, challenges, and so on. God didn't make them. It's just part of a universe in which there's freedom and the possibility of moral growth. So he's gone now, but a great contemporary philosopher of religion who developed this idea was John Hick in his book, Evil and the God of Love. That's a classic book on this topic, but he further developed the Irenaean theodicy, as he called it, into a larger system. But the basic idea of Irenaeus is that in order for there to be freedom of any kind, in order for there to be moral growth of finite creatures, there has to be freedom. And that will imply that there are choices and possibilities where we might choose against the good. And that's, you know, obviously that doesn't resolve all kinds of major questions. It doesn't resolve, for example, the existence of the Black Death, as it was called in the 14th century in Europe, but where, you know, a third of the population is just wiped out by a disease. It doesn't solve that, but it does give some other ways to think about growing with God as one of the possibilities.
Right. And it doesn't do the other side of it, which is judge everybody else by saying, well, if you died of the Black Death, then you obviously didn't have a proper faith. It doesn't go there at all. So I think that's another way of saying what it isn't saying.
Yeah. So that's one. Another one, it doesn't have a name. Charmaine and I coined a name for it. And we call it the Jesus Narrative Theodicy. And you'll find this in people like Daniel Migliore, or Jürgen Moltmann, the German theologian, or Bradley Hansen, Lutheran theologian. And you'll also find it, for example, in Julian of Norwich. Right? And so the idea here is the way to approach the question of suffering, of the reality of suffering and the existence of evil, is not to start with abstractions about God. Don't start with, God is omniscient, God is omnipotent, God is all loving, therefore X, Y, and Z should happen or shouldn't happen. Those are all abstractions. No, this theodicy says, actually, we start from the story, right? The story of Jesus. That's the center point of this theodicy. And that's where we look to get a sense for who God is and how God is at work in the world and what life is about and how to deal with suffering and evil. And so, basically, this theodicy will say no to any idea that God is somehow manipulating events so that suffering happens to people, because that would be contrary to the very thing that's revealed about the nature of God in the Jesus story, that God is love. God, as the community of three persons, the triune God, is by definition is essentially love. And so any attempt to deal with the question of suffering and evil that does not approach God in that question as a God of love is ruled out of order, because it doesn't square with the story.
Right. And so you look at what happens in the story. What is it, if Jesus is the embodiment of God in the world, what is it that Jesus is doing? Jesus is trying to alleviate the suffering of people. And he's not giving them a questionnaire first and saying, okay, have you prayed three times today? And did you give an offering? And, you know, are you wearing your best clothes on Sunday? None of those things. In fact, think about the woman caught in adultery. You know, there's no faith test. There's no righteousness test before Jesus touches people, heals people, tries to end their suffering, tries to give them some other ways of understanding who they are and what their worth is. The example of Jesus is part of the theodicy, that God is at work in the world, mm-hmm. trying to alleviate suffering through love, through care, through recognition of others' suffering.
And so one of the other things about this particular theodicy is that it imagines God as a co-sufferer, a co-traveler mm-hmm. with us, but also that God accompanies creatures in their suffering. God is not remote from human suffering. And for this theodicy, where you see that is in the cross of Jesus, right? Jesus' cross as the crucifixion of God incarnate shows that, or reveals that God is in the midst of suffering, experiencing it too.
Is willing to join us in the suffering, not sending it upon us, mm-hmm. but joining us in the midst of it.
And so in this theodicy, we have a divine partner who is lover, beloved, and love, who is experiencing things with us, and also at the same time calling us to serve the reign of God, which is to create a different kind of world. And so wherever this theodicy would say something like, wherever people are trying to work for a greater good for others, wherever people are trying to alleviate suffering, you can be sure that God the Spirit is at work in that particular instance. And so it doesn't have simple answers, but it at least gives the picture that we're not alone and abandoned in the misery and suffering that is the daily bread of so many people, right? And so I think, you know, that's got something to offer as well too. So the third one we'll mention is somewhat related. It's called a liberation theodicy, and it's connected to different types of liberation theologies, Latin American liberation theology, Black liberation theology, womanist liberation theology, which is African-American women's perspectives on theology.
Feminist.
Feminist theology, Mujerista theology, which is Latina theology. In every case, people who have experienced constant structural and personal marginalization, in these cases, they experience suffering up front, up close, and personal through racism, sexism, gender violence, and so on. This is a theodicy that tries to think from those perspectives. And one of the things that this theodicy will say is that the experience of marginalized persons really has to be listened to if we're going to talk about where is God in the midst of suffering. Because the suffering that marginalized people experience is almost always manufactured by other people. In other words, it's structurally created by systems of racism, systems of gender inequality, systems of economic inequality, systems of exploitation, and so on. So those types of evil and suffering in the world have human causes. And so liberation theologies are going to say, we have to name and do something about those.
Right. And in fact, they would say God is calling us to challenge and eliminate those sources of suffering. And God will empower us to do that. The Spirit will give us the strength, mm-hmm. the words, the courage to stand against governments or popular culture, to make changes that will bring an end to certain kinds of suffering.
So this type of theodicy is going to be highly critical of any pat answers that disempower people, like everything happens for a reason or God is testing you and so on. This theodicy is going to say no to that. We can change that kind of suffering, right? That, and we should, and we will find God as we try to change those types of suffering. So in this theodicy, like in the Jesus narrative one, God actively chooses to be present, in this case, with the poor and the oppressed and the marginalized of the world. That's where you will find God. And in working to alleviate their suffering, we'll find redemption, right?
And here, with that term redemption then is for the whole world, for whole systems. It's not just about me and my salvation. It's about this whole bigger sense that God is concerned about everyone and the systems that shape our world and influence mm-hmm. people. So this is about when we talk about the kingdom of God in Community of Christ, we're talking about societal redemption, societal salvation. And that's what liberation theology is pointing to as well, to that God cares about the whole world being fully alive, being fully equal, being fully able to access the riches of life in the world.
And this theodicy is skeptical of the theoretical kinds of theodicy. Well, if God is all powerful and all loving, how come suffering exists? One of those things must not be true. But that's all theoretical, right? And this theodicy says, stop doing that. actually go get engaged with the poor, the suffering, the marginalized, with people who are being abused because of their gender. Get involved there to change the circumstances in which they're, to alleviate their suffering. That's where you'll find God, and stop just theorizing, right? Get pastorally engaged with them and stop theorizing. And so this theodicy would say no to any kinds of theologies which say, just submit to the powers that be. There's an afterlife and things will be better afterwards. And, injustice and oppression, we just have to put up with it and take it. This theodicy says, actually, no, we don't. on the basis of the Exodus.
God cares. God cares.
Right. God, in the Exodus story, God came down, the text says, and saw the misery and then acted in and through Moses to bring liberation. And that's our charge too. So it's a different, it's connected to the Jesus narrative theodicy, but in some different ways. And it's more
active.
Right. Yeah. I was going to that very much. More activist in lots of ways. But so these are three different approaches to the question of suffering and evil that you can find in different Christian theologians. There's other ones too.
So process theodicy would say that God is either all loving or
God is all loving and all good, but God is not all powerful, and God is experiencing all this with us, but God is trying to figure it out as we go along too. Right.
God can't do anything about it. Right. So
God's power is limited.
Basically, you have to decide whether God is all loving or God is all powerful. And that's a very brief take on process theodicy. But there's other theodicies too, like protest theodicy, which comes actually out of the Holocaust, and also it's present in the Old Testament, but it's a theodicy that kind of is open to the idea that you can protest God. It's okay to say this suffering is unjust, and to complain to God about that, not to lose your faith, but to say, God, where are you in this? Why have you been silent? And so it empowers people to name the evil of some kinds of suffering and ask God, where are you in this?
This one, you can catch a glimpse of this in Elie Wiesel's classic autobiographical story, Night. The Jewish theologian Richard Rubinstein, his book, Theology After Auschwitz, articulates a protest theodicy. And there's no easy answers with this one. This one says God is, there is some infinite ground of being that is the source of all things. But you know what? It's pretty much up to us to decide what kind of future we're going to create. And we have to use our best resources to create a different future. And we're not going to hide behind religious cliches or
that somehow God is going to come and save us in the midst of suffering.
Right. There's no bailouts with this one. Right. We have to create the most just future we can imagine. I can think of a Jewish philosopher, theologian, Emil Falkenhayn, who wrote a book called God's Presence in History. And there's a little bit of this type of theodicy in it, but one of his great sayings in that book is, coming out of the Holocaust, here's God's new commandment to Jews. He says, thou shalt not give Hitler any posthumous victories. Right? That's a perfect kind of statement for a protest theodicy. It's up to us to stop anti-Semitism, racism, and the violence connected to it. And then one other that we didn't talk about was the Augustinian theodicy. It's roughly from the same period, a little later than Irenaeus, but the Augustinian theodicy has some interesting things in it. It basically says we have to look at the world, the whole system has been compromised by the injection of human sin and selfishness into it. And so there's no like storm-free zones here. We have mucked it all up. And so, you know, Augustine's doing this in the 4th-5th century, doesn't have access to modern science and so on. So he would see sickness and disease as part of the compromised system. I mean, he reads Genesis kind of literally, but he would see sickness, death, illness, struggle and suffering as part of a compromised world. One of the things he says is that God is present with us. And Augustine has the idea that God will use even our worst stuff. God doesn't create our worst stuff, but God will use our worst stuff and create different future out of it. The idea here is that God can draw straight with crooked lines. Our lines are always crooked. God is able to draw straight with them, and God will create what God needs to create out of it in spite of what we have freely chosen to do. So
kind of like God is ongoing a creator, and using even our mess ups as new possibilities. It's that ever inviting God. It's the God who finds us when we wandered off the track and finds a way for us to make it through the brambles back to a road.
These are so fascinating, you two. Like, I don't know if people starting to listen to this podcast realize that they were going to get this deep.
Sorry. We kind of get excited about this.
It's incredible. Like these six different theodicies are so interesting. And some of them have some similarities, but they are so, so different. Mm-hmm. And different ways to view God. Just it's a little bit mind-blowing. And I'm not sure that people just walking on the street would ever get there if they didn't like
sit down. And the thing that all of these have in common is that this is a God who isn't looking for reasons to punish us. These are all about a God who is wanting to invite us to be part of change in the world, in our own lives, moving towards goodness for all, rather than, you know, the idea that somehow we deserve to have comfort if we believe in God. It's like our little ticket is, if we believe in God, we'll get what we want. And that's, you know, in lots of ways, that's a kind of a childish understanding of, of why you do things. You know, you get an A on an exam and you get $5, you know, whatever, you know, and that's sometimes where we stay there with that idea of God, our own little world, our own little wants are what God is about, rather than, you know, God wanting to be with us and wanting us to want to be with God, within the struggles, outside of the struggles, mm-hmm. in it all. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I think yeah. it's just, we have a really long, rich history within Christianity of understanding God in a very positive way, of claiming a God who meets us in our suffering, doesn't punish us in with the suffering, or because we're not suffering good enough, give us more of it. This is a God who understands what it means to be human, and doesn't punish us for being human, but understands what we need, which is that forgiveness, that freeing up from our guilt, and that in as an invitation to keep growing, to keep making room.
And we also need to be freed from the illusion that there are simple formulas that we can latch onto that will just make everything better. There aren't simple formulas. The simplest formula I can think of is love God, love neighbor, love self. And yet when we try to do that, we recognize there's a lot of complexity in that. But you know, the idea that everything happens for a reason, or you're being tested, you must have done something bad to deserve this. Those lead in bad directions if you follow them through. They really do. And we can do so much better in terms of how we deal with that real problem of human and ecological misery and devastation. And so there are other resources that can help us think better, speak better, act better for the well-being of others, and the well-being of creation.
Yeah. And, you know, another thought came to mind is that one of the biggest problems with the, if you do good, you get good. If you do bad, you get bad. That means somebody gets to decide what the list is about what's good. And once you have a list that you are worshiping, that you're focusing your life around in order to feel like you have control and will have a comfortable life, then you don't need God. God is out of the picture because you're interested in the list. And a lot of churches, lots of denominations have a list. These are the good things you need to do in order to be good with God and to benefit from your relationship with God. Well, you know what? God wants us to benefit from a relationship with God. That's it. And besides, who made up the rules? Who said what's good? You know, often what's good is sexist or, you know, hetero, what's the term?
Heteronormative.
Right? Yeah. You know, somebody made up this list that said it, you have to be this, this, and this to be loved by God. And then you're not experiencing God. You're trying to prove yourself to a list. And that makes distance between us and God.
And behind all that is, in my view, the rhetoric of control.
Hierarchical control.
We want a formula and a list so we can control you. And in the political realm, when you have a formula and a list and control, it's called fascism, right? In the religious realm, you can call it fundamentalism, you can call it authoritarianism, but it's the same thing, only wearing its Sunday church clothes. It's still the rhetoric of control, trying to dominate and squelch others and to make sure that everybody looks the same way and acts the same way.
And raising yourself up into this role of God.
it actually has nothing to do with the Bible and has nothing to do with, it has nothing to do with the message of Jesus. It really has everything to do with people's fear and desire to control others.
And it actually reminds me of a meme that I saw.
Oh, what was it?
Well, it's something like, everyone's an atheist until you clog your friend's toilet.
Plunger God, right?
Everyone wants control until there's something really crappy that you can't control.
That's what my sense.
I feel deeply theological saying that right now. So I feel like I really hit the mark.
I think you that's something you would write on the bottom of a 10 question quiz. You would throw it in to see if I could give you extra credit for it.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true.
I probably would.
I would deserve it. I'm just saying. Well, this has been just a fascinating discussion. I know there's lots more to say about this, but we're almost out of time. You've just gone so deep into this. It's been wonderful. So I'm going to ask you for some closing thoughts on why do bad things happen to good people? If you have any closing thoughts, I'd love to hear them.
My first one is, reframe the question. That's not the question God cares about.
And the only thing I would add to that is, I'm obviously going to quote the Bible here. I would quote Romans 8. Nothing will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus.
That's beautiful. And a much, much better way to end the podcast than my meme. Although I hope that what people take away from this podcast is not just my meme.
It could happen though. We're okay with that.
No, we're not. Thank you again, Tony and Charmaine. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and to learn from you yet again. You're just fantastic.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.